As long as there have been personal computers, people have been using them to make games. They have made them alone, they've made them with friends, they have formed companies and sold them. They've given them away for free. People from all walks of life have made all kinds of games for all kinds of reasons. Most conventional game history leaves out games that didn't have a large impact on the broader industry. But the history of the games industry is not the history of games. There are countless games that run the risk of being forgotten entirely, but they mattered to somebody. Who made them? How? Why? Whose lives did they touch? The Fringe Game History Podcast is my attempt to tell some of those stories which might otherwise be lost. I'm Jeremy Penner, and this is the first episode of the Fringe Game History Podcast. For our first show, I'll be talking with Kirk Israel about Joust Pong, a one-button game he has made and remade several times over the years. The music you're listening to right now is the title theme from the Atari 2600 version of Joust Pong. Before we get to that, I want to make a quick apology. There are a number of spots during this interview where someone's voice glitches out briefly. I'm still working on my recording setup, and I hope this problem will be cleared up when I record the next episode. That out of the way, here's my interview with Kirk Israel, recorded on April 28th of 2016. Hope you enjoy. Joining me today is Kirk Israel. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sort of a geek by both professionally and personally, and my claim to fame, limited internet fame, in the sense of Andy Warhol was wrong. In the future, everyone's not famous for 15 minutes. Everyone's just famous to 15 people. And most of my 15 people, a lot of them know me just because of my Joust Pong game from the early 2000s, which was a bit of homebrew that ran on the Atari, the old Atari 2600, and had, you know, physical cartridges made up. And so, yeah, I got in the early 2000s, I got connected with the people who were doing that kind of thing. And that's probably what we're going to talk about tonight.
Yeah, well, definitely want to talk about that. I mean, there's Joust Pong specifically went through quite a number of variations over quite a few years. But I kind of want to start, before we get into that, maybe start a little bit at the beginning. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how did you first discover that making a video game was something that you personally could learn to do?
I think games, especially in the 80s when I was growing up, the gateway to making games seemed a little closer in some ways because the games themselves tended to be simpler and everyone was on these great old 8-bit home computers. And those computers all booted into BASIC. And by booting into BASIC, which you'd probably learned a few lines of in school, I think there's a great opening that led a lot of young people to try to program. And I think a natural thing to then try to program is games. And while professional games at the time were definitely levels beyond what you would probably end up with in BASIC, it wasn't as far removed as came later when games started to go 3D, and I think that got really confusing. So I think I think off of the 80s is always using kind of technology that was sort of at hand. And then in the 90s, it shifted to something called, for me, to something called Visual Basic, which was just a version of BASIC that would run on Windows 3.1 and just was empowering in the sense of now I could make these little apps in a window. And I actually taught a class in that at Tufts University. I kind of designed and taught. They allow students or anyone to design and then teach and a 4-credit class. And so I made one to try to help other people to get into making stuff in Visual Basic, because again, it's pretty accessible. The barrier to entry wasn't as high as for some other types of programming, especially for Windows, and you could just make things, include graphics, and again, games are something just people gravitate to. So, the very first versions of Joust Pong actually was a Visual Basic program first and foremost.
Cool. So
When you say like you might have learned some basic in school and you had these 8-bit computers, did you so like you would have been starting to do programming like when you were a kid, I guess, in the 80s, just a little bit. Would you have had like friends, people that you hung out with that you kind of did it with, or like you made games for people, or how did that kind of fall out?
It was hard. It was a pretty isolated thing. In terms of, you might be able to make something for you and your friends. I mean, or you might collaborate actually with your friends. In that era too, I think magazines, come to think of it, were another great sort of a gateway into realizing that this was something that was accessible and that something people could do, because you'd have these magazines that would come out, and you could have these type-in programs, and you would sometimes type them in. And the ones that were in BASIC were often harder to type, but you at least had more of a chance of kind of reading the code and seeing what they were, how they were doing, what they were doing. And the ones that were in assembly language were usually more impressive, but were kind of more obscure. So I think a lot of the attempts to kind of get to community back then were coming down from the magazines and for like for the Atari, there's Antic, and for the Commodore, I liked Computes Gazette. And then there are also ones that were kind of even more geared at kids. There's I think one called Enter, and even Family Computing would have a few listings now and then. And so, that's kind of a top-down community in terms of, or like there's still like a there's a sense that like if you're really good, maybe you can send it in, and you but you have to get lucky. Locally, I didn't have a lot of local community, just close friends and who I could sometimes work with a little bit. But it was kind of lonely pursuit back then, I think.
Okay, so obviously you've kind of drawn kind of a straight line through, you were doing this kind of as a hobby as a kid, and then you went on to learn Visual Basic, and you've been, teaching class and kind of have kept it up. So like, what's kind of drawn you what to, continue to spend your spare time doing this stuff, like making games and keeping at it, especially if it's kind of started out very isolated.
I think, like a lot of my, probably too much of my life is a little bit sort of attempts to, I almost want to say get attention. And I know, and I'm probably a little bit too self-deprecating about it, because I think the idea of creating something is noble in itself. And even if it there is the aspect of, you want something that can kind of show off and say, hey, here's what I can do. I think you have to. I think there's always going to be a little balance of those two. And the other thing is just making something that didn't exist before. I mean, programming is kind of special in the sense of there's nothing but a blank screen, and you type for a while, and then there's a something. And so it's almost like this, not quite divine, but this kind of sense of creation from nothing that I think is really gratifying. And then when it comes to games, I think it's, with the internet, I've had through various years made connections with communities, and I think less so now lately. I've sort of drifted away. I feel like I'm not as connected as I kind of would want to be. But sometimes it was both communities for playing games. I'm thinking especially back in the Usenet days, which was like these online kind of message boards for a lot of academic people and a lot of folks. And my favorite there was called Rec Games Video Classic, or RGVC. And a lot of that was just talking about, kind of playing games, and specifically games that were considered retro at that point, which would be mostly Atari. And then there's even debates like, well, is Nintendo retro yet, or what's this, and what, this kind of gatekeeping tasks, which are kind of silly. But I've really always liked these old games, in part because they're often very self-contained, and each one kind of could create a microcosm. And I think the ability to make a little kind of self-contained world with its own physics and its own feeling was always just a rewarding kind of sense of something to do.
So you mentioned Usenet. Maybe this is a good time to segue a little bit into talking about Joust Pong. So Joust Pong, as I understand it, kind of was inspired by a post in this Usenet news group.
Yeah, there was a sort of a spammy post back in, I'm not even sure what the date was, but it was definitely mid-90s, and it was talking about Gaming 2001, the future of gaming. Yeah, this is 98, actually. So it's trying to look like 3 years ahead. And then a guy who I only know as Otter kind of just came up with a great one line. The future of gaming can be summed up in two words, Pong and Joust. And that was just so, it's kind of odd, but kind of brilliant. And then, putting on the Wayback Machine, I can see a fellow named Dan Mazurowski. He sort of went off and kind of thought about it and thought maybe that could be a game. And he thought about this kind of mashup of a game. The game he originally described was more complex than any version of Joust Pong, and probably put the balance more towards the joust side, with riders and more riders and eggs and generations and stuff. So in some ways, Joust Pong took some of these core ideas and then distilled them, and sort of became it's just Pong with the flat button. And I really like there are two benefits to this. One is I really like the idea of games that can just be just this complete minimal control, and one button games are always a intriguing subgenre to me. And the other is, as they developed it in Visual Basic, it turned out to be pretty easy to make a competent but not overwhelmingly perfect computer opponent. That just by tweaking the idea of like, well, if the egg is above the computer opponent's head, it flaps, and otherwise it just kind of lets itself fall. That you could get that and a few other little variables so that it would start missing sometimes, which is important because in regular Pong, it's way too easy to make a computer opponent that just plays it perfectly. So it was gratifying that even the one player version could be there. And I would say, getting this idea too of what appeals to me about community video games, I've always been fascinated by head-to-head games. I kind of grew up, or I graduated college, and then it was the 90s, and then the Nintendo 64 came out with its four controller slots. And these head-to-head-to-head games are just really appealing and community-based. But on the other hand, sometimes retro gaming and gaming in general can be kind of lonely. So when you can, it's nice to be, as a developer, it's nice to be able to put in one-player modes, even if the game is pretty simple, just so that it still makes sense and you're not completely leaving out people who happen to be on their own exploring your stuff.
So, going off on a little bit of a tangent, maybe, but you mentioned fascination with one-button games. I just remember you have on your website a collection of actual, literally, it's like an HTML page, and it is literally like HTML buttons that have games in them.
Yeah, the game
So.
buttons I have on a, I think it's on my feature site on Kirk.is, and it was, well, again, part of my 15 minutes of fame was Boing Boing once mentioned them, and that was, yeah, just this conception that you could put a entire game from its display to the input. As a button, the display is just a caption, so it's a kind of a chance. It melds in with kind of ASCII art in terms of what can you do with a single row of characters that still has a meaningful game, and then put the input on the same one. And yeah, it was kind of fascinating that I was able to get some games that actually are almost playable.
Right. Was that kind of after you'd been playing with the one button stuff in Joust Pong? I don't remember the chronology of it, but
Yeah, I think a friend of mine named Renjit, who might have been bouncing some ideas back and forth, but I think it was happening kind of after Joust Pong kind of set this idea. And again, it to have one button be so literally one button was even another thing. And I think too, it came from the joke there's one game that plays itself, which is 1D Pong, and that is just basically two characters making a dash go back and forth forever.
So I kind of brought up that that whole Usenet thread, and it's kind of was kind of the joke post, and then people kind of talking about what Joust Pong or Joust plus Pong might be like. And then you kind of swooped in and were like, you know, if I had Visual Basic right now, I could just crank this out. And then literally like the next day, you're like, here's the beta. You know, I spent a couple hours making it. I don't know. I thought it was amusing. The last post in the thread is you kind of put the beta out there. And then this fellow who had been talking about his elaborate designs for combining Joust and Pong was, you know, people were immediately like making suggestions. Oh, you should add this. You should add that. Last post says, this all seems to be getting a little complicated. Kind of like the simplicity of my current beta. Also, I'm not sure if I'm going to be spending all that much time on this, which I think is, I don't know what the right word is. Ironic, probably, given the future of Joust Pong in your life.
Yeah, it certainly, the amount of effort it took to port it to the Atari was kind of extraordinary. And it's funny, there's even a lesser known side port at one point to even the Palm Pilot, because there's another kind of brilliant little device or little application called Pocket C that let you program on an actual Palm Pilot, which was this very, very limited machine. And at a time when, you know, laptops were not kind of the norm, but kind of expensive luxuries, the ability to sort of scratch out a program, you know, anywhere, even on vacation, was great as well. And again, it has this kind of self-contained nature that's always appealed to me, that like sometimes you can get the entire, I think I really like going back to the old magazines. Sometimes it's amazing, like, there's nothing except this listing, and this listing becomes a little world. And so sometimes I like systems where there's no external graphics, there's no external sound files. Everything is just kind of described as a thing of the text you've typed and the environment that that computer system provides you, that language. And Pocket C had that in spades, because it's just these like little memos I would scratch out with a stylus, or sometimes a little keyboard, but usually the stylus, and be able to make it. Yes. So overall, these versions of Joust Pong came out, and it became much more consuming. And the intriguing thing was, though, switching to the Atari, which was definitely such a labor of love, and had to learn so much, you know, kind of assembly language and all these little crazy little timing things. But also because I thought about, you know, making something that would be worth both people's time and also try to sell some cartridges. I felt kind of compelled to make it actually fancier than any version that came before, in the sense of there was I threw in the pterodactyl character, was the first complexification. And this is just a little bird that fly in between, and just add a little bit of randomness to it. And once I got that working, I was even, it still didn't feel like quite enough. It looked so bare on the screen that you just had like this kind of lonely play field, and, you know, the two paddles and a little bird and the bouncing egg or ball and the score, that I was actually encouraged. I don't remember quite the source of it, but either encouraged by myself or by people on the mailing list to even take it further. And it actually got blended with something like Breakout. So both sides, so rather than just being typical Pong, where if it gets past you, you lose a point, you're actually kind of guarding a wall. Or Warlords or Breakout kind of have the same idea, that now there's a wall that each person had, and that it would get worn away as you let shots past, and then there are parts that are vulnerable. So it added a kind of sense of a little bit more tension, because you start to get like a little bit more hyped up when like one part of your screen is more exposed because of where you've let it go past. And between that and also then the sound effects and other things, the Atari version was really the most impressive to that point, and a lot of that came from an urge to make something that was, yeah, just had a little more value.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit, just kind of to give a little bit more background on the Atari port. So you mentioned the mailing list. So for people listening, you're referring, I assume, to the it's called the Stella list, which I don't know if it's still active. But for quite a period of time, it was basically where the, I don't know, research into how to write Atari games from scratch happened. Like, as far as I understand, basically everyone who, you know, was trying to understand how the Atari worked and how to program it, and the people who were who developed incredible skill at writing software for the Atari hung out on this list and would give advice or would post new experiments or new ideas, and they would, there was a lot of people kind of helping each other out, which someone would post a program and then people would post ideas for how to optimize it or, you know, add new features or things like that. So something like that. As I recall, I was actually subscribed to the Stella list and interested in Atari development myself when Joust Pong was happening. And as I recall that process, you know, you certainly went through that with people making suggestions and helping you with code. I think, if I'm remembering right, when you had implemented the Warlords thing, the breakout feature, you were having trouble kind of optimizing the kernel to get everything on one scan line. And basically, you know, people were coming in and helping you, like saying, okay, well, here's a kernel that will do everything you need to do without glitching out and that kind of stuff.
Like, yeah. Yep. I would say that, like, there are a bunch of names that I can kind of think of, even though it's been a while. Like early on, Nick Bensema, even though he wasn't a, he wasn't one of the superstars, but so I could kind of appreciate that he wasn't like a guru from the outset. And he did some interesting digital clock stuff as an inspiration. I remember there's a very patient guy, Dennis Debro, who was just very helpful and kind of supportive. And then on the hardcore, like the super guru levels, Thomas Gents, I'm sure I'm mangling his last name, but a guy from Germany who just loves getting into the deep nitty gritty and just pushing this hardware to way beyond where people would have thought it could have gone. And then the incident you're thinking of, Paul Slocum. I think if I remember correctly, I'd gotten a kernel that was kind of okay. Mm-hmm. It could even do the Warlord stuff, and it could do all this juggling to get the walls set up. But it was what they call a Flickr kernel. Now, the Atari, notably among its many limitations, is the fact that it kind of only gives you two really complex, called player graphics. So two kind of complex looking things at once. And then, but the trick is you can reuse them if you're really clever. And the couple ways you can, and get multiple things that you might need to make a more complex game. The most basic way of reusing it is called Flickr. And, you know, I think the old Pac-Man game has this way too much in that it's just like different frames, you're showing different characters. And so half the time the thing is basically invisible, but it doesn't matter because the next frame of the TV picture refreshing itself is going to show it something else and then back to it and then something else. And so it flickers and it's livable. And that was the version I had. Another shortcut you sometimes get is strange things like you just make it so the players can't be on the same kind of horizontal line on the game. So you kind of make arbitrary gameplay rules that, like, oh, these things won't be at the same place in the same time, and then you can avoid the flicker. And, you know, Joust Pong couldn't work like that, so that was a no-go. But Paul Slocum came up with this brilliant idea, and he used this little artifact that the Atari has where you can like multiply characters. So like Space Invaders has six aliens across, and that's because it uses the fact that you can triple a single alien and they do that twice, and that's how they get the six. And then you change it to tripling or doubling or whatever as invaders get shot, and that's how that like Space Invaders works. And his brilliance was taking that fact, plus the fact that if you took one of these like little triplets or doubles and shoved it way to the side of the screen, the clone of it would appear on the left side then. So if it's shoved all the way to the right, then the other one appears on the left. And by juggling the timing and doing this crazy magic, he was able to effectively push that player and use the exact same kind of object for the player on the left and the player on the right. And so that meant the pterodactyl flying around the middle could always just be its thing kind of on its own. And he just wrote it for me. And, you know, he saw what I was doing and he took it and did it. And so that's sort of the dirty secret, that as much as I like to feel chuffed for having conquered the assembly beast and having made the kernel humbly, what actually made it shine was by a guy who just did it for kicks and did it better than I was capable of doing at the time, or even now.
Yeah, just like hearing you describe that trick, I'm like, oh man, that's really like, that's just such a leap, right?
And so many of these guys are so into the kind of tricks that they were really, I mean, it's a testament to the people who made the original system that they kept it as wide open as they did, and there's enough room to kind of play and fiddle with stuff. And it's interesting too, because you know, one thing we might want to get into is over the years, once things shifted to Batari Basic, you know, this kind of version of Basic that took care of a lot of those hardcore details. And made it a lot less onerous and lets you kind of focus on more of the gameplay. But some of that, for people who only know that, you know, some of those tricks aren't really accessible to them. And so they are more, for better or worse, but probably better, are stuck with more of the mundane smarts. And you're not going to see as many tricks as customized to the circumstance of the game as you did during the heyday of having to do it the hard way.
Right. How long did it take you? How much time did you actually put into Joust Pong on the Atari?
So I started it in I think it was 2002, and then I had a kind of long hiatus of about a year almost, and then I just really hunkered down towards the end of 2003, and then getting it finished in spring of 2004. And the funny thing is, and this is kind of mixing up cause and effect or something, but if I'm feeling really cynical, I'm like, oh man, did this cost me my marriage? And I don't think that's fair to me, you know, to my past self to think that. But it was around the same, you know, same time when, or kind of shortly thereafter, my marriage of a few years went on the rocks. And I think it's more indicative of, you know, I wasn't probably as focused on that relationship that I thought it was the kind of thing where like, oh, this marriage is like the basis where I can do all this other interesting stuff. And, you know, it provides other needs and I provide it and I work at it to a limited degree. But I think the idea that I was kind of toiling away kind of didn't help. But again, I'm not sure if that's more of the cart or more of the horse, you know, the kind of end result. And it's funny because that took, you know, call it a year roughly of, you know, of programming. And then last year I was able to make another game, Loaded for Bear, that I literally did over a weekend.
Right.
And that's because there've just been some new amazing tools and community, and just the barrier to entry has come way down. Just to, you know, just to continue about this, because I think people, if they don't know about it, it is kind of fun that this guy named Fred Quimby, who goes by the nickname Batari, he did something that, again, is one of those technologies you like think, oh my gosh, they could do that. And he just wrote this great cross compiler, so he could write in this odd little variation of BASIC, and then you know run on your PC and it would compile the code, and it took care of the really hard bit, which is that again that kernel, the thing that Ian Bogost wrote in Riding the Beam, where you just have to struggle to get all the timing exactly perfect. And like, well, if you make a compromise here and there, and just you're content with the basic stuff, we can make it so all the logic is done this much easier to understand basic level, and he can program a game with it without really having to know assembly. And that's just an amazing reduction of the barrier to entry, and it has really opened up the field. Now, then the flip side of that is that a lot of those games both can't be and aren't as polished as some of the early generation ones, but there are exceptions to that. Some people either just use it for the logic and then still push it, or they just use these specialty kernels, still kind of off the shelf, but still do things that just have all this ambition. Mm-hmm. But it's just amazing that it came from a course, you know, it came from being the project of a year to the project of a weekend. And I really appreciate that and the people who keep up the good work of, like, guy goes by the name Random Terrain, of making sure that it's, you know, reasonably well documented, and you can kind of follow, you know, you can kind of learn, you know, how to do it, you know, roughly from scratch.
Yeah, I mean, I've made a game in Vatari Basic for, I think it was, might have been for a Ludum Dare game jam, but I literally did it in a coffee shop in like a couple of hours without really having used Vatari Basic before. And, you know, while I'd been kind of a lurker on the sidelines looking at these, you know, I have an understanding of, you know, how the Atari graphics system works. Like, I really didn't need it. It was just kind of like I could, you know, it was all very self-contained and kind of general purpose. You know, the kind of genius of Vatari Basic is really, I mean, it's 80% in the basic language. So you're not writing assembly, and then the other 80% is in, you know, the standardized kernel that can just, you can actually draw stuff on the screen, and it's actually general purpose enough that you can put lots of different kinds of games in it. Whereas, like, it's not like you could take the graphics code of any particular Atari game and turn it into a completely different game.
Yeah, and the basic kernels made some interesting compromises in terms of, like, saying, okay, we already don't have enough much memory to play with, but what we do have, we're going to map that to the screen memory, and so you have these like big blocky things to play with on screen. That was, you know, actually another kind of tie-in to the almost what programming was like back on the old 8-bit computers, the old home computers. And I think that'd be another lesson that I learned in kind of studying how Vatari Basic was doing what it did, which was there's more of a connection with BASIC and assembly language than I kind of realized. Mm-hmm. In the 80s, I always kind of thought, in some ways, BASIC as an interpreted language versus something that you can kind of have a separate compile kind of run step was an interesting choice, because in some ways it made these slow machines even slower. That the computer had to think about each line kind of as it ran. It couldn't just, like, it wasn't just tucked into a nice binary file. And so when I looked at the structure of how I was doing things in a Vatari Basic, it's pretty straightforward to see how that would go in the same logic and assembly, that you're not probably relying on a lot of subroutines and kind of farming out your code and kind of quote proper computer science style. You kind of have just one big loop. You're just going step by step by step, and you're just doing simple conditionals and simple memory manipulations, you know, variable manipulations in both. And so it was sort of eye-opening to realize that assembly was actually closer to the BASIC I grew up with, even though when I was growing up, it seemed so far and so inaccessible.
Right. Yeah, and that's kind of, if you think about how, if you look at something like Batari Basic and you think about, oh, how actually trivial it is to compile something like that to something that runs fast, it's like, why did I ever write a for loop for 1,000 and have that, wait for a second, right? Like, I don't know. I guess, the interpreter itself, the program itself had to be small, and the whole point was to make it accessible. And having an interpretive loop rather than, a separate compile step is.
And I remember some gimmicks to get around that, like especially on the Atari side. So my first home computer was the Atari 800XL, which was almost, now that I think about it, far and away a much better programmer's machine, like a amateur programming machine, than the Commodore 64. In terms of its basic, was just richer and had a lot more sound and graphics built in, whereas things on the Commodore side quickly got into a kind of a mess of peaks and pokes. And on the Atari side, there were these cartridges that were like, that was like the super, promised to be super fast basics that I realized must be of would take code and kind of compile it.
Right.
And it actually just reminds me too of I mean, the reason I switched from Atari to Commodore was, frankly, the pirate game culture, honestly, which is I'm a little bit chagrined at, but now to think of, but was certainly a kind of compelling thing that it just had a more vibrant scene where you, as a kid without much spare change, you just needed some discs and a connected friend, and you could get all these a wider range of games. And that usually, even though the systems were about comparable in specs, usually it seemed like the Commodore version had a little bit more zip to it. Though the Atari had its own advantages too. And again, that's interesting about what the culture was about then, where as much as it was, amateur programming and kids learning how to program and doing basic stuff, and 10, what's your name? 20, print, hello, your name. That also it was going hand in hand with these systems were also what you'd play the games on. And again, seeing that it wasn't too far away from some of the games that you'd see were something that you could make almost a version of, what was a very encouraging time to get started with that stuff.
Yeah, I feel like I wonder if, if you hadn't had access to, all the different, this pirate scene and oh, here's all the cool things a computer to do, whether, typing in 10 print, what's your name, would have kept being compelling, right? Like the one of the things for me, the computer I spent, I'm certain more time just playing around with stuff that ran on the computer than I spent programming the computer, but that's kind of part of what got me inspired to make stuff, as I'd see something and I'd be like, well, how does that work? So, you kind of need, they kind of go together, right?
Yeah, and again, you had these ones that were booting into BASIC, and that's so important in the early 80s relative to once DOS came in, like, oh, you have something that does nothing but load stuff. It was just like, this is just nothing to see here, just pass on through to whatever you're actually going to play. But the fact that you had these basic commands there, was just tremendous. And then it's funny when I think about it, and I think about these early games I'd make, and sometimes I think my favorite was like I'd make a little I must have rewritten this game like 4 or 5 times and always basically the same thing, but it's like I'd make a little kind of like a canyon by making a slash character and like 4 or 5 underlines and then another slash character and then just do that line after line after line, and maybe move it to the left, move to the right, snake it left and right a little bit, and then the whole game would be you're the little dot character who has to try to stay within the boundaries of the cavern as it slides back and forth, and you just rely on the printing, the fact that when you printed it at the bottom, the whole screen would scroll up.
Right.
There's that, and then on the Commodore, I would tend to do the. I love the idea of I don't know, just like it could be like a microscope that would be like looking at. like this little critter, because you know what did I have? I have an asterisk. I could move around the screen. Then I could press have it so you could press the button and a dot would appear, and then the thing would kind of slide over and go ahead and eat the dot. Or sometimes I realized since the rounding errors were such, it would just get locked in eternal orbit, going around and around, or sometimes in a figure eight and never quite being able to change its speed subtly enough to actually pick up the dot. But having the concept of X and Y speeds is this well I go back to again and again and again, whether I'm programming Joust Pong on the Atari or I'm doing various games in a language called Processing, mm-hmm. which is another excellent tangent and just source for artists and students to learn to make something. But when I make these games, I still love this idea. Like, I don't always want to fire up a full physics engine. And in that case, it's just so pleasant to just have, you have an X and Y position and you have an X and Y speed. And then you just add the X and Y speed to the X and Y. And if you need to accelerate or decelerate, you have to do it by changing the speed. And it has this nice fluid motion that has this kind of Newtonian grace to it. And you know, finding variants of that is just something that I've done a lot, and it really started in these kind of Commodore 64 little microscope have a thing just kind of skate around the screen.
That's cool. I've always wanted like to have, I don't know, some kind of museum of like developers' first basic games or whatever, like HyperCard stacks or whatever you started out making the simplest thing. Like, I think it's interesting what people would make. Like, I made tic-tac-toe over and over.
Did you make it two player or just one player? I mean, did you make it just one player or, sorry, which one?
Tell me. No, it was totally two player, like not even an AI. Yeah. Just like,
yeah.
I remember just like, because I was bored and like on a school computer and didn't have anything to do and it didn't have anything on it, but it had QBasic. And so I would just like, okay, well, I'm going to make tic-tac-toe now.
Could it detect winning conditions?
Yeah, I think so. I think I managed.
Yeah, that was. I remember explaining to my aunt as a precocious 8-year-old, like, here's my tic-tac-toe, and see if I. And I realized if I had to always just check what are the possible ways it could have won, like vertical, 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 horizontal, 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 the two dot diagonals, and you know, laboriously checking each one, mm-hmm. Each time. And I was explaining to my aunt, and she was. For a smart, not smart ass, but little precocious, convinced he's a genius kid, you know, having an adult say, wow, that's probably something I wouldn't have come up with, you know, was just so weirdly ego gratifying. But that's a great idea, though, that I mean, in terms of, you know, what was your first program? And I think, unfortunately, for people of a certain age, you have to kind of take their word for it, or their half recollections. Yeah. Just there's so much bit rot. But I could definitely see myself making a little cavern run game. Mm-hmm. And it's funny too, as you talk about QBasic, which postdates my earliest days, but I saw a little more in like high school. And of course, that was another one because they had that Gorillaz game, right, with the bananas, and. That was a really nice example of something that, you know, you could see the guts working underneath it and tweak it and make little variants of it and it had that kind of just showing how the sausage is made aspect to it that sometimes you just don't get as things get more polished.
Mm-hmm. I always I took from Gorillaz and Nibbles, like I just stole code. Like, I didn't understand any of it, but like they had these title screens with like it had like these dancing asterisks, like a marquee kind of around the screen, and then it had some text in the middle explaining or whatever, and I just like stole that for all my games. I'm like, well, I want dancing asterisks.
I'm
just gonna tear this out. And like they all had it.
Yep.
There was like another graphics demo or something that was like drawing these wireframe spheres and like connecting them with lines, and then I like saw that. I don't even remember where I found it, but like I saw that, it's like, that's my company logo. Right.
Oh yeah, and the whole joy of just making up your own little companies. I mean, I've been using, at least since high school, you know, Alien Bill Productions, my little running eyeball.
Right.
But it's always kind of fun kind of making your own little company and playing with the logo aspect of it.
Yeah, it was just like, I just literally stole it.
Gosh, that was another fun one I had. That's a side tangent to, I think, a lot of people's experience, but the Atari computers had this awesome version of BASIC, or no, sorry, awesome version of Logo on a cartridge. And the one on the Atari was just better than almost anywhere else because it didn't have just one turtle. It had four turtles. And it wasn't just a turtle, it's a triangle. They look like cute little turtles. And the whole language itself also introduced like demons, which are, you know, event-driven programming is like a huge concept and something that you just never found in BASIC, where you're always like querying things all the time. Mm-hmm. And so putting that together, I think the other program I probably did almost as much as the stupid cavern run was putting like three or four little turtles in the aquarium with a, you know, a little bounded circle. And then, you know, every time they'd hit each other or hit the side, they'd turn around and usually still managed to escape somehow. I'm not quite sure how that worked, but yeah, it was just a charming language. And then, you know, years later I find out, oh, I was actually Logo. I'm actually programming in a version of Lisp without so many parentheses and getting some of the same concepts down. And I think it's important to recognize, as maybe people of your age and my age, like we try to help younger people get into it, or, you know, and not force it on them, but just see if it's a path that makes sense for them. Sometimes, you know, you do run into like, oh my gosh, these kids really don't know what, these kids don't have the kind of mental framework yet. It's still developing to think about what it means to break a program into something, into step-by-step, it's just the skill. It's like the universal programming skill. It's like, here's a task. How do we break it up into these small little components so that this idiot computer can do it step-by-step? Mm-hmm. And some of those learnings took place, you know, literally, geez, like 35 years ago for me. You forget that you can be otherwise. There's a high schooler I was helping out, you know, just doing some consulting. A friend asked if I would sort of do it, and just over email, and had a kind of neat little dungeony game, but you know, everything was hard coded, that the room definitions were all kind of living in code. And on the one hand, I was thinking, wow, you know, that I didn't think I had much to show him because he's using some technologies I didn't know much about, but I could, you know, I could just introduce this concept of, you know, you separate, here's the code that runs things and here's kind of the data. And then you can more easily tweak the gameplay if you can tweak the data. But then I was thinking, you know, as simple as that seems to me, in some ways, the professional game industry, I've heard stories that that was the big hotness in like the late 90s, you know, as late as that, mm-hmm. or maybe the 2000s, that like making data-driven stuff and being able to tweak a game and the engines and the physics without having to recompile, and maybe even letting other people, while one engineer is kind of trying to get the engine working, the other people can like saying, okay, here's what we have. How can we just change the numbers to make a different feeling to it? You know, that was a revolution that came late too. So I should understand that these are actually fairly sophisticated things that aren't as, that even for professionals haven't always been as blatantly obvious as the way you should do things.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And I think it's interesting too, just like, you know, just certainly my experience as a kid, I had so much material available to me. You know, I had, you know, these basic interpreters and, you know, I didn't have necessarily a lot of magazines, but I had a lot of books that were like just weird, you know, cute little basic games that you could type in and run. And, you know, they were all themed. So I had one that was all games about monsters, and I had one that was like games about the Olympics. And, you know, you could just kind of look at them and you could type them in and play them. And it was just kind of in the air for me. Like, it was just all these kind of helpful, you know, resources were around. Certainly in my experience, there was, not really of a question of, how do I learn to do X? It was, oh, what am I going to learn about today? What's this new program do? It was just kind of like, not even just like directed, focused, like there was so much kind of unfocused learning, when I was growing up, just like learning, what was possible and like just from because there was so much out there for me to try.
And some of those magazines or those books had such a hard time of it too, because they'd try to be like for multiple platforms, and you'd have these things like, here's the basic version, but if you're on a VIC-20, you have to do this, and if you're on an Atari or Apple II, you have to do this other thing. And sometimes they couldn't even use even what the graphics different systems had, or it's just these weird hacks to make have a code base that was like kind of universal, but then all these little tweaks you had to get it to work on the individual machines. But yeah, I mean, and that sense of like it, what's out there. I mean, I think that, it's still always going to be a problem, and it's sometimes potential for delight when you realize there's been a community around things like, or things you missed out on, like I think there's stuff like Blitz Basic and this really interesting idea of making, these kind of very primitive 3D systems, kind of in the same spirit of Quick Basic or QBasic. And then you have little communities that build up around them, or then Anna Anthropy had going into the world of what was happening with ZZT, which was kind of similar, and I knew nothing about. And some of the stuff that you've dug up in terms of the click and play communities, and again that culture of, both doing it sometimes in kind of elementary school or settings, or and sometimes trying to bust out to the real world of shareware and having people send you either postcards or maybe registering for that, a $5 a bit. But I think, yeah, the world obviously technology has kind of changed and not always for the better. And I try to think of what the equivalents are today of like, now of being in class might have some, more about like producing documents kind of for the web. I mean, documents sounds like a negative term because you can do, but almost more from a group might be interesting from a graphics design and telling a story kind of point of view. And, but also with this idea that it's going to be connected and you can probably find a place to put it online and then everyone can see it. But again, still trying to get attention is still this, the same struggle that it always was. But definitely the medium has shifted from like basic as like the thing on your whole computer to now you have this kind of interesting world where you can put stuff and other people can see it, through that kind of connectivity.
So, like, I want to talk a little bit about audiences, I think, and that's just kind of like outlets for your stuff. And maybe, rather than kind of what's going on now. So, like, even your original Joust Pong, right? Like, you posted it to the VB version. You posted it to Usenet, just kind of version 0.1, and presumably, put it up on your website at some point. Did you like how many people actually found that version? Like, did you put it out there more? Was it really just kind of, originally made to participate in this thread, or
Yeah, I think I've never been great at tracking the numbers for this kind of stuff. And I think to some extent, it's almost self-protective because I think often the numbers are going to be pretty tiny. But you're getting this issue of distribution. And I was sort of an early adopter for having my own place to put stuff in terms of my own web space. First on a academic my university's computer systems and then going out on my own for my own domain. But yeah, I think the web itself has always been a challenge for it's easy enough to get something so it's available, but then that question of how do you bring attention to it? And obviously there was I think I'd assume most of it would come through people who might see it through Rec Games Video Classic. But you know, you might, I would try to play, you know, the search engines of the time and try to make sure there's listed on like maybe on Yahoo, which was still at one point was still kind of a very manual human entered listing. And then whatever keywords, and then there were programs or there were, link exchange programs and just trying to be with there. I think once it shifted, I think one of the appeals of shifting it to kind of programming on the real Atari then is that it engaged a different fan base. Now at that point, that was right kind of on the dawn of Atari age as sort of being this very, very neat cultural point for all these people to come together. But that was certainly a way both of finding some level of audience. And then of course they are doing so much great stuff and actually making physical hardware, which you almost can't say enough about how gratifying it is. And basically they're doing all this smart engineering stuff. I mean, admittedly, some part of me feels a little guilty that they're taking old, sometimes taking old Pac-Man carts, and the shells having the getting the new life as these new games, which of course means there are fewer Pac-Man carts around, but there are so many hundreds of thousands of those around that it's not really such a big cultural loss. Mm-hmm. But the idea that they know enough to get these carts and do the grunt work and burn these chips, and then you can plug it into this physical hardware and see it on a real screen, is just a truly beautiful thing. And then also with cart in hand, you know, playing, so the convention scene, I went to Philly Classic, you know, that was the big debut of it. And actually, I sat at a table with the creator of Yara's Revenge, Howard Scott Warshaw. And that, you know, that was just sort of nuts that here's this guy making these, you know, true cultural touchstone games. And then here I am with just my little hobby hackathon kind of thing. It's fun. And then also neat, I've got the t-shirts printed up for him because, you know, everything's a little better if I have a commemorative t-shirt.
Sure.
And, you know, and did that run. And it, yeah, I mean, it's definitely not something you would do as a, it's definitely a labor of love. And there are certainly many other things I could have done dollar per hour basis that would have been better. But it's always satisfying when someone likes your stuff enough to plunk down for it, even though part of that too is just the collector aspect.
Right. Well, what I was going to say is, actually, you know, thinking back on it, you really can't stress enough how important Atari Age was to just like compared to what had come before. So I remember it wasn't super long after I joined Stella List, but the way people were getting, you know, their software put onto real carts, and there was a guy who was doing it. It was Hoser Video Games, I guess. Hoser Video or something like that. He had this weird weird cartoon logo of like a guy sticking his tongue out or something like that. And he was just kind of, this was how you did it. And like, at one point he just kind of disappeared. He just like stopped and like that outlet was just gone all of a sudden, you know. He used to be able to, you know, he would sell the games on his website and he would take a cut or whatever, and he was just, you know, was done with it. And like, it was this whole messy thing. But then kind of, you know, Atari Age was really able to kind of pick that up and is still around and doing it, kind of in a much more, and is somehow able to do it in kind of this much more professional way that, you know, I don't know how they can manage to, you know, still do it. And there's a big enough market that, you know, they've been able to keep around for so long.
Yeah, I don't even know. I mean, remember the guy, his name, Al,
yeah,
was the was a driving force. And I don't even know what the aspect of, making some level of money versus just labor of love. But definitely, like you're saying, very essential to the community and bringing a, it's real professionalism to it, that wasn't around as much. And I think the other avenue some of them are pursuing that are just different ways of getting onto like physical hardware sometimes. And I know they have these special carts and stuff, and you can kind of beam stuff in either by SD card or whatnot. And even easier than I remember, I actually went ahead and bought one of the old Stella adapter units. And it was always kind of wonky because the it had a slightly irregular audio port. And so it wasn't quite as reliable as you want. But it's, again, just that neatness of seeing on the physical screen. And but I got to say, that's kind of going away too, because it's becoming harder and harder to maintain kind of hardware that you can plug in an Atari into. That it's usually, Atari had this kind of weird, the two-prong antenna things. And then usually compromise sometimes is this little, get a look at a coax cable adapter, but it's hard to get a clear picture with that. And so that once you've exhausted that, you can get in some you have to almost get in custom hardware if you really want a kind of a quality picture. On the other hand, I mean, if you can suck it up, if you don't quite mind the purity, two things you can do is one is they do have now some awesome adapters to plug in real joysticks into a USB slot. And then so if you're playing an emulator, you have the real controls. And then I kind of have mixed feelings about like on the emulator, you can just switch it over so that it has crappy TV mode, crappy color TV mode that kind of captures the echo. And something I wonder is like, oh, do I like that? Because it's like more authentic and or not authentic, but it's just more like the experience was back then. Or do I say no? Every generation wants pictures to be as pure as it possibly can be. So it's sort of false and betraying of what we can do by going with that. Conversely, though, I do think if you can get the right joystick hardware, I think it really improves the experience.
So when you kind of went on to play with Pocket C and build it for Palm, and you had a web version written in Java as well, was that kind of to scratch an itch, or like were you active on like Palm Dev, some Palm Dev group similar, to like how you were on Usenet, or what was kind of the impetus between those?
Yeah, I think it was. Sometimes it's almost looking for something to do. I mean, because Jaspong, especially in this pre-Pterodactyl form, ports really easily. But I think the itch, it would tend to, personal itch, that sounds kind of gross. Pocket C had a little community that was, I mean, it had message boards, let's put it that way, and actually didn't have a lot of, didn't have too much of a big vibrant community, and so everything was a little bit was back to isolation. And I think the Java version was it's almost practice in Java and just trying to get to something that I could actually play in the browser. I mean, I think that goes into, I think of all these ones that the program environments that I've found since then, other than this, other than the pure retro stuff, processing. And it has some awesome sites like openprocessing.org and just all these places where people can go ahead and display, and it's amazing to browse. Now, the tragedy, of course, I just said that it's great to be able to share. I think, it was the move to Java was I wanted to be able to put it in a browser, which you could do in 2003 or whenever I did that. Of course, Java is sort of going away, and processing is having to adapt and kind of run it in sort of a JavaScript version. But so it's just funny how it's a lot of it. I think it is chasing that, like, well, how can I make something that people can they can actually, people can bring down their own computers. And in the late 90s, that seemed to be Visual Basic. In the early 2000s, that was these, you know, Java applets and then switching to processing. And then now it's stuff that has to, you know, run in JavaScript, and that becomes sort of the universal standard. So still, again, processing is, has managed to be viable, keep itself viable, you know, kind of across that gap, and still my favorite go-to for fun little toys and advent calendars and games and stuff. But a lot of it is just the distribution that I want to be able to put on the web. And, you know, there aren't any more flea markets of, you can't go to the flea market. I remember they used to have, you go to these, you know, computer expo shows, and you'd have these things of shareware, and it'd just be, you know, floppy disk after floppy disk after floppy disk, of these poorly labeled stuff. Usually, you know, and usually, hopefully, the version that was meant to be distributed. You know, and that's obviously not the mechanism that, many people rely on anymore.
It's funny that, you know, you've out of the four implementations of Joust Pong, the one that will probably run best in the browser now is the Atari version, because there are actually emulators that compile and run in the browser.
That's almost true. I think a couple of years ago, there might be a fifth version that it gets even less play.
Okay.
Or less attention, but I think there's a big, there's a Flappy Bird game jam.
Okay.
And Flappy Bird, I'm sort of amused that, you know, of the connection, and you know, Flappy Bird had this immense day in the sun. And you could do a whole session on just Flappy Bird and the whole kind of masochistic type of game style. But at its heart, it's the other one button flappy control system, just like Joust Pong.
Yeah.
That just combined it with this, you know, intensely difficult bit of maneuvering between these pipes. And so, anyways, there was a Flappy Bird jam. So I think I've actually ported it to processing JS. So it runs in the browser, and, you know, we have to see. It's an interesting question, right? Which is going to last longer? People running 2600 emulators, or a certain flavor of JavaScript that sticks around until someone decides it's a security hole and patches up some stuff my code depends on.
Right.
That's yet another port. That's actually has the distinction of being the only one besides the Atari port that actually threw in the sort of pterodactyl character again. Right. Most of the ones just go with the simplicity of two paddles and a ball, and that's it.
Right. Well, that's cool. I didn't know that existed. And once you make the Joust Pong Flappy Bird connection, it makes complete sense.
Yeah, it's I admire Flappy Pong because sometimes there are other people who try to do like these one button games, and I've seen some weird ones that like that have a lot of different modes for that one button. Like they're really trying to shoehorn the idea of a more complex scheme into a single button. But you know, Flappy Pong, you know, just keeps that simplicity. I mean, I see some of those actually games for iPad. There's multiple player ones, and sometimes you switch to it because it's tough if you're already having to share a screen, that sometimes you just have these ones. But unfortunately, I don't have the example at hand. But I do appreciate the elegance of what can you do that's just has that minimal control, and not just when is the flat button. It's interesting too because it doesn't matter how long you hold it. So it's actually like it's even simpler than it could be because it's not even off, on or off at any given point in time, and how you maybe could hold it longer, but you let go, and or it doesn't matter how long you hold it because it's basically just a click,
right?
Click in effect.
All right. Well, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but yeah, I don't know. Is there anything else you wanted to like that you've been thinking about or that you wanted to talk about? With regards to your experiences, you know, making stuff, or
I think you're talking about, you know, community is really interesting. For people who might not know, talking a lot about the Glorious Trainwreck site and the idea of getting people doing kind of game, you know, these 2-hour game jams of intense community. And two, I think about how I've sort of, I feel a little bit like home. I don't know, homeless, but yeah, I've looked at some of the other ones like Select Button and, you know, After the Gamer's Quarter kind of went away. And it's hard because I think to find the right community, I think it's like, it's big enough that it matters that if you do something, you'll have people looking at what you do, but not so big that you just kind of get lost in that, like, only an all-star thing. Like, you know, Minecraft was that kind of all-star thing that just like did get on these boards and just really took off. And again, Flappy Bird in a different, less with the community, more just with a pure kind of app store kind of model. It's again, that is that one that kind of hits the lottery in terms of getting attention and getting people intrigued in it. You know, but there's so much going on all the time that it's sort of tough to keep track of and find that home. And it also has the problem that so much else kind of in the world, like when Facebook came on the scene and with the same idea of like, that Tumblr and Twitter and Instagram and all these have of like, okay, you don't have to be interesting by yourself now, like on your own blog, but we're just going to, you're going to be part of the feed and conversely saying here, you can just assemble a feed of people you find interesting, either because you know them in person or because it's, or because they write funny quips in Twitter or they put interesting graphical stuff there, like in Tumblr. You know, it's really hard to compete with that idea. And so in some ways you're leaning against these communities that are more, you're leaning towards communities that are more general purpose. And it's sort of almost harder to find a nice home of people who are just interested in a topic.
Right.
So, you know, there are pros and cons to that. But, you know, it is what it is. And so it's just kind of, just trying to find and stay connected to people. And just, yeah, finding like-minded people who might be interested in whatever you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's always a challenge. And, like, I can think of lots of stuff that, you know, even back in the day that I would be interested in, but I wouldn't necessarily, like, stumble on people having a conversation about it on the internet, right? Like, something like Pocket C, I toyed with it a little bit, largely when I was, I did do Palm development myself a little bit. There was a version of Lua that was quite nice that I played around with a lot. But, like, I think, yeah, I remember the Lua one had a sort of a message board, but it wasn't something that I ever participated in or anything. I just kind of did my own thing. But like a lot of it, I was just, you know, again, kind of would go around just searching for stuff that was out there and, you know, wouldn't necessarily have any kind of opportunity to connect with the people who were doing it or you know, you know, I don't remember there being like a Palm development community that I participated in or anything like that. It was just, I had this thing, I was trying the different things that you could do with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, largely what I remember doing is like finding the, you know, a site that had just lists of stuff, you know, lists of freeware and just going through it. Just like, you know, trying to get as much, find something that would be entertaining or whatever, interesting to play with.
Yeah, Lua's a funny one too. There's a version of it for iPad that I toyed around with.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go through the demos of these, which is kind of akin to what you're saying about like seeing what people have done, the ones that comes with are just astounding. Like this weird 3D, you know, this kind of 3D roller coaster one and all this stuff. And that's an interesting system where sometimes we just live in this weird abundance of stuff and community is a problem because like even though it's super cool, it just maybe doesn't ever find its niche where it really explodes, even though it can do so much. And it's interesting contrast again thinking about the old school computers where like you could kind of learn like 90% of, well, it felt like everything of what the APIC computers could do. Now I'm hedging my bet because then years later you'd see these super hackers who could go in and like do these demos that would just like blow your mind and just seem a light year beyond what they were doing back then. But still, the systems were like knowable, and they relatively had fewer surprises. In terms of, you could understand the chip. If you wanted to, you could learn all the chips and all these memory locations and get a big idea of what it could do. And now it's like, oh, I have a Wii U. Does it play Blu-ray? I don't know. You know, like, you know, or I don't mean to pick on Nintendo, but I think if I get a 3DS and it has all these, once these systems started coming with like operating systems that just booted, and like now there's like this weird, you know, little things to take advantage of the camera and just do little things with either sometimes with the internet or other modes. And, you know, as you get old, you know, it's tough to know. Am I just getting old and jaded and there's just so many other things to distract me with? Or is it just that we live in such an abundance of so many objects that do so many cool things that we just don't have the time to kind of take that attention and learn systems as deeply?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's like, you know, when I went to, you know, was trawling, you know, Palm Freeware sites or whatever for things to do, was because, you know, my Palm didn't already do everything I wanted it to do. Whereas, you know, you've got this, you know, a 3DS and it's got a camera, I got an iPhone, it's got a camera, it's got a, you know, everything that, you know, it's got a web browser. And the idea is that like 90% of what I want to do with this device is already there. It's served to you. And so it's not always necessarily, you know, obvious to look deeper. And if you're not, you know, if it's just presented as here's a thing that does things, you know, it's just, it becomes the sum of the things that it does. It doesn't become, you know, an object that you can wonder about or, you know, feel like you can contribute to necessarily. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and things have gotten so, just opaque, right? That again, in the old 8-bits, everything was kind of right there. And you had a little bit more, you know, palm exposure, but you know, you could still get the sense of how things worked. And now it's just more and more just seeming like, oh, it's kind of like magic.
Yeah, well, I mean, software at this point is really so complex that, you know, you can't understand it all. Nobody, there's nobody who does. Top to bottom, you can understand the principles, but like in terms of what software is actually running, what, you know, code is actually, you know, I've got a laptop here right now, like trying to understand exactly what's happening in any particular piece is just like, there's just too much.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And the skills kids are getting to navigate this stuff, you know, like, some of it is just letting go, and sometimes it's just like, this just kind of works, and I just kind of roll with it. And I think for some of the older school geeks, you get the frustration. It's like, oh, I can't really understand what's going on here. I mean, it takes my – I have that same effect with programming that I think I'm not as – sometimes I'm not as effective as a programmer as I could be if I was more willing to let go and just, like, use these powerful systems they don't really, really have a good mental model of. Because I still like that knowability of it and just the idea of modeling it in my head and having it surprise me a little bit less often.
Well, I mean, I think it's, you need to have some kind of solid mental model, whether that's, you know, exactly how it works all the way down or not. Like, you need to be able to predict what it's going to do. It's certainly, I don't know about effective, but like, you know, there are some problems which you could probably just be mucking around and poking at stuff until it does something that looks like what you want. You know, when I was a kid, that's how I thought programming worked, because that's what I did. Right? Like...
Yeah.
And then kind of, as I went along and became more disciplined, then it became more interesting to understand how a system worked and understand all of the details, because... I mean, for me anyway, like writing, my first programming job was writing C code. And once you started getting into weird memory corruption errors and stuff like that, you know, you just kind of, that's that's the way you're effective to write C code, is you have to understand how memory works, right? You have to understand what could possibly cause this, spooky effect over here. If you just kind of bang on it, not understanding it, you're only going to make it worse.
Yeah, yep. So just I guess I'll do a final shout out that I guess Joust Pong is still available for purchase, though it's under the name Flapping since Atari decided it owned everything with the word Pong in it. I thought I was going to get busted for using the Joust graphics actually.
Yeah.
But they're just more concerned. Their lawyer's primary concern was with the name Pong. And so Flapping was an actually doesn't I think the name maybe Thomas actually suggested that one. And then pretty clever, reasonably clever pun. And I think it's still available for purchase at the Atari Age store. I think once he sells up another couple dozen of them, I'll probably get a second royalty check. So,
Exciting. Yeah, definitely check that out. It is definitely a neat game, and maybe I should I don't think I ever actually bought a cartridge, so maybe I should do that.
And it is actually is. One of the things I'm proud of it is that, I've run these little tourneys, and it's actually a very compelling little game. That there's something kind of, I mean, in the same way Flappy Bird tapped in on this, there's something close enough to reality but far enough apart from what we actually experience that it's kind of compelling to kind of master the positioning of this flapping and then combine that with the classic Pong, get the angles just right and send it to your opponent and then maybe wear down their wall and get them a little nervous about think about it too much. And it's actually I'm proud that of the gameplay ultimately and what it came out.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, no, I definitely, it's a cool little game, and people should check it out for sure. If that wasn't obvious from, me calling you up and recording an hour and a half of audio talking
Yeah.
about it. But it is neat. And it's definitely cool that, it's still available. And you can pick up a copy if you still have an Atari and a TV that will look like something if you plug it in.
The whole long tail of Atari merchandising.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks so much for coming on and talking to me, Kirk. It's been
Yeah, my pleasure.
really good to have you, and good luck finding your home and all that.
Yeah,
So.
back at you, and I hope this whole podcast thing turns out to live up to all your ambitions.
Yeah, thank you. I think this one turned out pretty well, so we'll be trying to branch out and do a little bit more in the future.
Awesome.
Thanks for listening to this first episode of the Fringe Game History Podcast. I'm Jeremy Penner, and my guest has been Kirk Israel. I'm very interested to hear your feedback. You can find me on Twitter as @SpindleyQ, spelled SpindleyQ, or send an email to jeremy.penner@gmail.com. If you know someone whose story needs to be told, or some weird old forgotten game that needs to be explored, don't hesitate to let me know. There are so many interesting directions we can explore. Hope you'll join us again soon. Thanks so much for listening.